There's a theory floating around the vast ocean on the internet, and it says that all the films made by the Pixar company are connected. More specifically, they all exist in the same universe, just at different times. I won't spoil that too extensively, but if you haven't seen Pixar's movies, you may want to plug your ears for a minute or two. But the idea is that the whole thing revolves around the eventual awakening of machines like cars and robots and even toys, some changes in the animal kingdom, and a shift in the relationship between humans and the two other groups. The theory seems to have started as fan speculation, but a podcaster and film critic named John Negroni built it into something bigger and saw where all the loose threads began to weave together. Negroni traces the chronology of the big Pixar arc to a source in the film Brave. In Brave, a young Scottish princess named Merida sets out to prove that she should be in charge of her own destiny, and inadvertently winds up getting her mother turned into a bear. There's a lot more to the story than that, of course, but what you need to know is that at one point, Merida finds herself and her horse, Angus, in an ancient ring of stones. As she examines the megaliths, she begins to see a strange glowing light in the forest, then another, and another. These are Will-o'-the-Wisps. They actually go by a lot of names, like Ignis Fatuus, Jack-o'-lanterns, Hobby Lanterns, Ghost Candles, Spunkies, which is likely what Merida would have known them as, since it's the Scottish term, and frequently in North America, Foxfire. Now technically, what we call Foxfire is a very tiny fungus that grows in certain types of fallen trees as they decay. Poplars supposedly make some of the best Foxfire. The fungus, which is actually any of a number of different fungi, is bioluminescent. It glows through the presence of a chemical called luciferin, which oxidizes once it's exposed to the air, and creates a pale green or blue glow. The phenomenon is actually somewhat common, although it's hard to see unless you're away from electrical lighting and in deep darkness. Mark Twain has Huck Finn and Jim look for foxfire-infected wood to help light an escape tunnel. Many folktales in Europe and America talk about the phenomenon of foxfire or something similar, appearing in forests or graveyards, and beckoning unwary travelers off their paths, sometimes making them hopelessly lost in the process. Foxfire is sometimes attributed to fairies, or devils, or other unearthly beings. Chasing foxfire is supposed to get you lost, but sometimes it also takes you to places that you didn't expect to go. That's kind of the idea here, too. This is Chasing Foxfire, and I'm your host, Corey Thomas Hutchison. Each episode, we look at a piece of American folklore, and then follow it, as it takes us away from the straight and narrow path and into other places, like history, science, nature, medicine, literature, popular culture. Sometimes we get a little lost, but we always wind up in interesting and unexpected places. This episode, our first, is all about things that glow in the dark, even when you don't expect them to. In Chapter 1, Angels Glow, we'll hear the story and the science behind glowing soldiers on a dark Civil War battlefield. Chapter 2, Meet the Beatles, is a tale about a canoe trip, some bugs, and one spectacular nighttime display. I hope you'll stay tuned and get a little lost with us today. Chapter 1. Angels Glow. The American Civil War was bloody. Really bloody. I mean, almost as many people died during that war as in all other American wars combined. The Battle of Shiloh in West Tennessee was one of the bloodiest battles in that bloody war, which left nearly 23,000 men dead or wounded. From April 6th to April 7th in 1862, the Confederate Army of General Johnston, numbering around 40,000, met a similar force under Union General Ulysses S. Grant. Johnston was fatally wounded in the fight and replaced by General P.G.T. Beauregard. The Union eventually pushed Beauregard from the field, and the guns went quiet. Now, bullets on the battlefield killed plenty of soldiers, but a significant number of Civil War deaths are attributable to disease and infection rather than lead and gunpowder. Medicine in the camps was often rudimentary, and soldiers were just as likely to die from unsterilized surgical implements as a rival's gunshot. To top that off, evacuating the dying and wounded from the actual fields in which battles were fought could take days. That was the case at Shiloh, where men languished for up to 2 days in the mud and the muck, often succumbing to their wounds before they could be seen by a camp doctor. Temperatures in early April could get close to freezing at night, and soldiers were prone to hypothermia as well. But some soldiers seemed not to have as much of a problem with infection as others. They survived when others didn't. What's more, they glowed at night. The phenomenon was known as angel's glow, according to some sources. The faint bluish-green glow would emit from the soldiers' wounds in the dark. It seemed eerie and otherworldly at the time, and the soldiers' survival rate reinforced the view that something extraordinary was happening. It turns out the soldiers were right. It was something extraordinary.
They wanted to do a science fair project. And so they thought that they could look into the glowing wounds and see if they could show that, because the reason they had the glowing, you know, the reason the wounds were glowing is that the people who had the glowing wounds seemed to recover better than people whose wounds did not glow.
That's Phyllis Martin, a retired scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where she specialized in bioluminescent microbes. In 2001, her son Bill and his friend Jonathan Curtis were discussing the story of Angel's Glow, which Bill had heard stories about on Civil War battlefields. He was an enthusiastic history buff and a budding folklorist.
It was the 9th Wisconsin that the story came from. But we had been to Shiloh. That's why he was, you know, and he was collecting ghost stories and, you know, any stories that could have to do with the Civil War at the time. He was younger. He was very into, you know, wherever we went, he collected ghost stories, all this kind of stuff.
Bill and Jonathan decided to use their high school science fair project and Phyllis's collection of bioluminescent bacteria at her USDA lab to figure out what was causing the angel glow phenomenon.
It was about the time he was learning to drive, so that when I went to work on weekends to subculture my bacteria, you know, he would drive me and I would do it and I would show him. I showed him these bacteria that glowed, and he said, well, could we do a project showing that those bacteria, you know, might inhibit the kind of bacteria that caused infections and wounds? Because in the Civil War, most of the, you know, after amputation or even with wounds, the big deaths, you know, were caused from infection after the wounds. He made that connection that, you know, the bacteria might be doing something okay. About that time, people were talking about, you know, maybe completely sterile fields for surgery was not the best. That maybe if we put some innocuous bacteria on there, that, you know, infectious bacteria wouldn't be happening. So there was stuff happening in science that suggested that there was that bacteria could compete with each other to, you know, to prevent infection. Then I had some strains of the bioluminescent bacteria, and what they did is they grew them together at different distances, and they measured zones of inhibition.
What Bill and Jonathan discovered showed that the bioluminescent bacteria were actually blocking the growth of the more dangerous infectious bacteria. As the glowing microbes competed for space in the wounds of the soldiers, they created a sort of invisible barrier around the wound site that prevented other potentially deadly bugs from invading the soldiers' bodies. That, of course, led me to wonder how the glowing bacteria got to the soldiers in the first place. Phyllis wondered that, too.
Okay, so this is great. So I said, well, okay, now you got to figure out how did the bacteria get there? Because these bacteria don't occur very, you know, they don't occur everywhere. They did some research, and the bacteria are carried by nematodes. All right, so where on the battlefield might you find nematodes? Well, there's a peach orchard at Shiloh, which just happened to be where the 9th Wisconsin was, where we heard the story. So now this stuff is making more sense. And there's a peach orchard nematode. There's a peach nematode that carries photorhabdus in its gut. Okay. So normally, to find a concentration of photorhabdus, the nematodes would have more photorhabdus than in the soil around it. So, okay, so now we've got everybody there. We've got the 9th Wisconsin. We've got rain. Okay, that's another important part, because nematodes can't move. They move with water. That sort of got the whole story. And they found that the nematodes would come to blood. So that's what they found out, and they wanted to find out what the antibiotic was. That was what they were going to. You know, if they were going to continue the project, they were going to go look into. And within a couple of years, they had, the scientists had sequenced the photorhabdus genome, and indeed there were antibiotics, very similar to ones that were already known that the photorhabdus strains secreted.
In addition to the natural occurrence of the microbes in the peach orchard, another factor played a part in making Angel's Glow happen at Shiloh.
What if we did this at different temperatures? And they found that at the bioluminescent bacteria were best at the temperature of about, 27 degrees, which would be about 60, a lower temperature than body temperature. And they found out that if the extremities of the body were lower temperature than the rest of the body, it still wasn't low enough, but, they were looking at it. So then they went outside, mm-hmm. and they took their socks off and stuff like that. And they found out that if they were out there for, 10, 15 minutes, that the body temperature would go down enough that the temperature would be very similar to what the photorhabdus would grow at.
That synchronicity, the alignment of factors like environment, temperature, and even the increased incidence of bacteria stirred up by the battle, all of that came together to create the eerie, faint glow that soldiers observed out on the field. Those who witnessed it experienced it as something otherworldly and tremendously special, possibly even touched with divinity, hence the name. And in a weird way, it was something special. For all those factors to come together at that place, at that time, well, it was like a house of cards or a domino chain. Everything had to line up to get that glow. And it did. Amid the horror and the suffering of war, and we should probably remember that these soldiers were lying wounded and unattended after one of the Civil War's bloodiest battles. But after all that, the right puzzle pieces fell into place and added a layer of wonder to the aftermath of the fighting. But there is another story of confluence here, and another way that this strange glow created an ideal convergence.
Well, I think it was because my son Bill was very interested in the Civil War, in the folklore, and John was very interested in the science. Yeah, and the other thing is that they were perfect together, working together. John was very capable working in the lab. He was very technically competent and always thinking about how to do things better, easier. And my son, which I was amazed at, was able to take the data and actually draw conclusions from the raw data. But what amazed me about it is he could see patterns in the raw data. And that was like, wow.
Angel's Glow brought John and Bill's interests together and allowed two high school students, one of whom had a mother with access to bioluminescent bacteria, true, to pull back the curtains on a 150-year-old mystery. The two teens followed that strange light through history and through science. And in the end, they shed a little light of their own. And that, too, is pretty wonderful. Chapter 2. Meet the Beatles. When Frank P. LeVar,
oh, this is Frank,
took a group of Boy Scouts on a canoe trip in Tennessee, he expected that they would travel down the river, camp, and generally build character in the way that Boy Scouts do during group trips. Frank has been working with the Boy Scouts for years, and he's seen plenty of amazing things. But during this particular camping trip in 2014, Frank saw something he hadn't seen before. After he and the scouts had put in for the night, he was hiking along a short trail when he stumbled on a scene that stopped him short. He tells the story better than I ever could. Here's what happened.
We have an annual trip that we take first part of June every year, which is a 50-mile trip on the Buffalo River. Tennessee, which then runs into the Duck River, and they both empty into the Tennessee. When it was discovered, I thought one of the boys was exclaiming in delight about another beautiful thing that we were going to observe, and that was the clear skies and the stars. We were very far out where there was no light pollution, and it was a very clear sky, and since astronomy is another one of my big interests, we had all decided to go up to this upper field from where we were camping on the shores of the Buffalo to look at the stars. And so we're making our way up this trail to a field that was a little bit higher than the river level, and the first boy that got up there could hear him exclaim something like, "Oh my God!" And I thought he was taking delight in the stars, which were also very beautiful. But as each person get up there to the field, everyone is saying, "Oh my Lord, I can't believe this!" And so I'm thinking, wow, isn't this wonderful that they're getting into this beautiful celestial display? Well, I was sort of bringing up the rear, and when we got up there, I also just said, "Oh my Lord, I can't believe it," because it wasn't until we got up to the field that we then saw this absolutely unbelievable display of fire. Flies, lightning bugs. And what had happened is, for some reason, I don't know why or how, but just tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of fireflies had all congregated on this field. And they were so closely together that it literally looked like a carpet made out of little lights, and they had completely blanketed this entire field. It was several acres, and that's what we just couldn't believe. No one had seen such a huge gathering of fireflies. And if that weren't enough, all of them had also gotten in the trees that were surrounding this field. There was a big open field, but all around it was a border of trees. And the fireflies had also gotten up in the trees. And so you had this carpet of light, but then it looked like surrounding the edges of this carpet were these draperies, if you will, of lightning bugs. And of course, they're all flashing on and off, and provided just, I think, one of the most incredible displays of nature that I've ever seen. And you know, they went on for hours, and just I think one of the most satisfying things that I've ever seen in my life. It was absolutely unbelievable.
What Frank was seeing was part of what's called a synchronous firefly display, when huge swarms of fireflies all gather together. In some situations, they blink more or less in unison, and in some situations, like the one that Frank saw, they simply all come to the same spot and form a living carpet of light, as he said.
These were not pulsating all in unison, which is another phenomena that does happen, and happens, I know of, in two places in the world. One is in East Tennessee, and that was the display that my sister saw. And there's someplace else, I can't remember where, I think it maybe is Japan or something, but that's where there's this huge congregation of fireflies, but they are all flashing in unison. And ours were you know, sort of at random, so there was this just incredible lots of lights going on and off. I don't know if one is more impressive than the other. Each are equally impressive, I think. But the only other thing that I can think of that was really neat was my friend John, who told us when we were looking at the fireflies on the buffalo that he and his wife had experienced a similar thing in Nashville at Edwin Warner Park, and that was a large congregation of fireflies that for some reason were all flashing in unison at the same time. But what made their experience so amazing was that they were doing it to the beat of the music of the radio that they had in their car.
Not every firefly does it. Only a few species are known to synchronize this way. They return to the same locations each year to show off their glow to one another, and to a few lucky humans as well. In Elkmont, Tennessee, close to where Frank was, there's a huge gathering of these fireflies, Photinus carolinus, and the park rangers in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park have to be careful not to allow too many people into the area during the display to avoid any dangers posed by humans to the insects. They provide tickets to the Elkmont fireflies at no extra cost than park admission and parking. They just use the tickets as a means of crowd control. In the Allegheny National Park in Pennsylvania, park rangers also have to monitor tourist numbers to avoid stressing firefly populations. There are similar displays in Asia as well. People are just drawn to this phenomenon. Fireflies do seem like some of the easiest insects to like, after all. Kids catch them on summer nights and keep them in jars, and hopefully release them at the end of the night. They have a magical quality to them.
Everybody was sort of in a state of disbelief, particularly since we weren't expecting it. You know, the people that go to the display in East Tennessee, where they're all flashing in unison, they've gone there because they specifically have gone to see this, It is a recurring event. It happens every year, and a lot of people come specifically to see that. What made my experience and the experience of my scouts so amazing was that it was a complete and total surprise. We went up to the field to look at the stars, not even expecting to see fireflies, and then had this wonderful surprise light show where literally thousands and thousands of lights, and in some places, like I said earlier, you're so thick and so close together that it looked like a carpet of lights. And that just, everybody found that to be just so incredible. And it's almost like you can't believe, is this for real? I mean, is this, how can there be so many together at the same time in the same place? Because most of the time you see fireflies, they're, you know, few and far between. But to have them, for some reason, I don't know why, come together and be packed in, and then just spread this carpet of light in front of you, it just seems out of the world. You know, it's almost like a dream. You think, no, this really cannot be happening, but it was.
The phenomenon of the firefly synchronicity left a lasting impact on the boys with Frank. He says every time he takes a new trip, the boys from the previous trip share stories with the new members of the group, the same way they might share campfire stories of ghosts or hook-handed men. The fireflies are legendary now, folklore in and of themselves. They're exactly why stories of foxfire and will-o'-the-wisps hold such fascination for us. How could we not be absolutely enchanted by that kind of display? How could we help but feel moved by that kind of light in the darkness? While some of the synchronous displays happen in the same place every year, the scene Frank and his scouts happened upon hasn't happened again since. Every year, Frank still has the happy task of leading these expeditions, and he's still watching for the display again. It made an impact.
We were planning to look at things in the heavens and just got doubly rewarded by having the firefly display, as well as a beautiful star-filled night above. And, you know, so we had the best of two worlds.
There was no hand to hold me back the night I found the ancient track over the hill and strained to see the fields that teased my memory and reached the crest to see outspread a valley of the lost and dead. And over Zaman's hill, the horn of a malignant moon was born to light the weeds and vines that grew on ruined walls I never knew. The foxfire glowed in field and bog, and unknown water spewed a fog whose curling talons mocked the thought that I had ever known this spot. Around was fog, ahead the spray of the star streams in the Milky Way. There was no hand to hold me back. That night I found the ancient track. When H.P. Lovecraft penned The Ancient Track in the early part of the 20th century, he aimed for the uncanny, the strange, the weird, as it was frequently called in the pulp magazines in which he published his stories. Weird tales sat outside of the comfortable mainstream of Western stories or crime dramatizations that sold tremendously well in the cheap books market of modernizing America. Tales of the unusual, however, had their appeal, particularly as people became more and more alienated, both from the natural world by new technologies that were rapidly transforming a rural nation into an industrial one, and then alienated from those very technologies by horrors like chemical warfare in World War I and the atomic bomb in World War II. The tech alienation often became science fiction. The radiation-swollen monsters like Godzilla, or the spate of flying saucer tales in the 1940s and 50s. The alienation from nature took its toll too, and often appeared as something grotesque, something horrific. Lovecraft's poem paints Foxfire as something cold and almost malevolent. Robert Frost, in his poem The Woodpile, finds an old stack of lumber infected with foxfire, whose purpose, he says, is to warm the frozen swamp as best it could with the slow, smokeless burning of decay. In the work of Frost or Lovecraft, foxfire is haunting, but it also provides illumination, revealing the ancient track of Lovecraft's poem or a hidden story of someone who'd spent himself, the labor of his axe, only to abandon his work in Frost's verses. That seems to be what these faint lights in dark places do. They show us just enough to find our own way. Whether that's the pale angel's glow after a bloody battle that eventually tells us something about bacteria and friendship, or a sudden flash of beauty under a dark sky as thousands of fireflies turn into grounded stars. These lights captivate us. They make us wonder. They show us wonderful things. I'd like to thank my guests for this episode, Phyllis Martin and Frank P. LeVar, for their time and their stories. And thank you for listening to the show. If you like what you've heard, please let others know about us. Feel free to leave us a review on iTunes, or find us and share us on Twitter or Facebook. You can find links to our pages on those sites in the show notes. And if you really like what you've heard, consider heading over to our Patreon page and supporting us, and maybe get some cool perks as a patron too. You can find us at our website, chasingfoxfire.com, or send us an email at chasingfoxfirepodcast@gmail.com. Chasing Foxfire is produced by New World Witchery and released under a Creative Commons share and share alike license. Our music is licensed from Magnatune, and you can find links to the artists behind the sounds in our show notes. Next time on Chasing Foxfire.
Howdy, Brer Rabbit.
Where call my name? Hello, Uncle Remus.
There's still a pushback against him. Disney hurt Harris's reputation to be on other Harris stories.
We hope you'll stay tuned. Thanks.